Chapter 23. Having spent 20 grueling minutes in her office, Jackman and his superintendent went down to the incident room where every available officer had gathered for an extraordinary meeting. Knowing the efficiency of the station grapevine and the gravity of what had occurred, it was doubtful that there was anyone who hadn't heard what had happened to Ernie Teal. However, it was expected that Ruth would make a formal announcement to her officers. She had told Jackman that she wanted to dispel any rumours that might have spread. "We have released the news of the death of a serving police officer, but withheld his name until the family and his friends have had time to grieve in private. The public have been asked to be aware of the danger posed by this gunman and as far as possible to stay indoors. I have endeavoured to avert wholesale panic by assuring them that this man has specific targets. He's not a spree killer who will massacre random victims." She looked around the room. "Although this hasn't been broadcast, we believe he is actually a hired gun being used by Ashcroft. There has also been some speculation that he is a loose cannon and may turn out to have an agenda of his own." When she had finished, Jackman took the lead, giving a progress report on the sniper and Alistair Ashcroft. "I've just heard from Uniform that the 4x4 Jeep Cherokee, which had been stolen, has been found abandoned and burnt out. No surprise there. There was a CCTV camera at the gun club, but the police vehicle obstructed its line of sight, and there are no cameras on the route he used, so..." He raised his hands. "We've drawn a blank with that line of inquiry."
"How about the owner of the vehicle, sir?" asked Gary Pritchard. "Was there CCTV where it was stolen from?"
"It was taken from a quiet cul-de-sac in one of the Salton villages, Gary. No one saw or heard anything, and there is no coverage out there."
"Private domestic cameras?" asked Robbie.
"Uniform have already spoken to the neighbours," said Jackman. "It seems to be a very untroubled community, mainly retired people, and no one has cameras. I think we're wasting our time continuing along that path. We need to step up our efforts in the search for Ashcroft. So far, we are assuming he stole a motorcycle from a nearby village, concealed it, probably somewhere at the Lorimer place, and then took off when we began to show an interest in Ezra Lorimer. By then, we had already begun to suspect that Ezra was, in fact, Ashcroft in disguise."
"We heard from Humberside Police that he killed the real Ezra, sir. How did he murder him?" asked Rosie Cohen.
Jackman understood Rosie's interest. During the original case, one of Ashcroft's nightmare murder scenes had sent her into freefall, and she had been signed off duties for weeks. Murray answered in his stead.
"In a manner most unusual for Ashcroft, who, as you will all remember from last time, usually devised horrendous methods for dispatching his victims, Ezra had his throat cut. Their report said it appeared he had been drinking with someone in his caravan. There was no sign of a fight, and they believe he must have been attacked from behind while enjoying a glass of whiskey. When forensics get their reports through, they will send us a copy."
Jackman continued. "We suspect that Ezra Lorimer had outlived his usefulness, so Ashcroft simply terminated him. If you think back, Ashcroft always felt he had a divine right to act as judge, jury, and executioner regarding people he considered to have escaped judgment. He believed that he was righting wrongs. But Ezra had done nothing wrong. He was simply Ashcroft's ticket to insert himself into the Lorimer family.
And once there, he used the innocent, gullible sons to steal a rifle and cause various other annoying disruptions in the area," concluded Marie.
"Now he has finished with Ezra, the question remains as to whether he will adopt a new persona, or will he move forward as himself. Our last clear picture of him is almost a year old, and we don't know how much his appearance might have changed in that time."
"Also, he was injured in the collision with my motorbike," Murray said. "We have no idea if he has scars now, or possibly a limp. He didn't seem impaired in any way, did he, Robbie, Charlie?"
They shook their heads. "No, Sarge," said Robbie. "Nothing we noticed. I want you two to try and recall anything at all about the man you believe to be Ezra that might help us track our killer." Jackman looked from one to the other of them. "And no beating yourselves up for not realizing it wasn't the real Ezra. Ashcroft is a consummate actor,
and if he could fool Ezra's own relatives, you lads didn't stand a chance.
Still feel like a plank, muttered Charlie Button.
Well, don't. Stop feeling angry at yourself and channel your energies into catching the bastard.
Jackman stared at the gathered officers.
Look, I know it's tough. Officer down are the two words we most dread hearing. But also, spare a thought for PC Kevin Stoner. He's been taken to Greenborough Hospital. His parents are with him, and he is being temporarily cared for there. What we don't know is why he in particular has been chosen to witness three shootings at close range and to be first on scene at the initial death, that of Christopher Keyes. If any of you, as his friends and colleagues, can help us with that, any suggestion, even if it's tenuous as hell, please come and speak to one of the team, okay?
How is he, sir?
Asked PC Stacy Smith.
We don't know, Stacy. You all know what trauma like that can do. He's a tough kid, but I guess only time will tell. He is being counselled by the force psychologist, Laura Archer, and she'll update me as to his progress. He paused.
This is not going to be easy, I know, but I need every one of you to try and put aside what has happened and get out there and find the sniper and Alistair Ashcroft. They are both right here in this town and probably hiding in plain sight, especially in Ashcroft's case. Find them for our dead colleague, and for heaven's sake, find them before we lose any more of our number. He watched them file out or return to their desks. He had asked a lot of a station that had just lost one of their officers, but he had no choice.
Coffee, boss? Marie asked.
Please, and as strong as that crappy machine can make it.
As Marie headed for the vending machine, Robbie approached him.
Oh, when you said if we think of something, no matter how small,
spit it out, lad.
It came to me when you were asking us to consider whatever we recall about our meeting with the fake Ezra. Sir, he was wearing a very expensive cologne. I mean, it wasn't drenched, but I caught a hint of it, and I recognised it immediately.
Come into the office, Robbie. But go get Marie first. I want her to hear this too.
A few minutes later, clutching mugs of hot coffee, they mulled over what Robbie had told them.
Why on earth, when you were disguised as a rough countryman like Ezra Lorimer, would you wear an expensive fragrance? Asked Marie. Ashcroft doesn't make slip-ups like that, so why would he do it?
That's one for the psychologists, murmured Jackman. Pity Laura is tied up at present.
Marie looked over her drink at him.
You could ring Sam Page, boss. He's helped us out before.
I might just do that. What did you say it was called, Robbie?
It's one of Penhaligon's portrait range, sir. It's called Terrible Teddy. I have a friend who wears it.
Marie snorted. Bloody funny name for a cologne. Jackman had seen the collection in Harrods. It was made by a company who had a royal warrant and a reputation for quality, having been established way back in the 1800s. It also cost a small fortune.
As far as I remember, all the fragrances represent a member of the aristocracy. Is that right, Rob?
Yes, sir. I forget what my friend told me about it, but I think it could be why Ashcroft likes it so much.
He pulled out his smartphone and tapped in the name.
Oh, yeah. He'd like this, all right. Listen, Teddy was a smooth operator who lived for the thrill of the chase.
And it's expensive? Marie asked.
How expensive, exactly?
Robbie searched again. Eau de parfum, just under £200, so I'd say very.
Marie let out a low whistle.
Hellfire! And Ashcroft was wearing it in a crappy, falling-to-bits motorhome? Why?
She frowned, then added,
And if he's so bloody clever, why hand us a potentially major clue on a plate?
Jackman picked up his phone, found Sam Page's number and put the question to him.
Sam was silent for a while. Would be my guess that he wanted to retain just a little of himself even while acting as someone else. He needed to remind the world at large what a powerful man he is. He would know that none of the Lorimer family would recognise the scent, and it made him feel superior. Plus, as we know, he is a megalomaniac. As far as he is concerned, anyone else who happens to smell it couldn't possibly be clever enough either to recognise it or realise the implications.
Jackman thanked Sam,
and said he would contact him again later, after he had ascertained how Laura was getting on with Kevin Stoner. Their meal might have to be postponed yet again. Sam said he understood completely and hung up. "One thing's for certain, sir." Robbie looked almost fierce. "If I meet him again in whatever role he assumes next, and get the slightest whiff of terrible Teddy, he's dead meat." "What you've found is important, Robbie. It could help identify him. And the best thing is that it's not something you can grab a bottle of in Superdrug. It's a statement perfume, and something very few people could afford. At last, something concrete. If it were cheaper, I'd get hold of a bottle and give every officer in the station a whiff, just in case they find themselves in his company. Can't see Ruth Crook's budget extending to cologne from Harrods, can you?" said Marie. "Don't worry, I'll pinch my friend's bottle. I'll tell him he's assisting with a murder inquiry, and I promise you he can afford to replace it." Robbie grinned. "He lives and works in Peterborough. I'll ring him and tell him I need it as a matter of urgency. He can courier it here, no problem."
"He'll do that? Wow, I'm impressed," Jackman said.
"He owns a national courier and parcel delivery company. So if he can't, no one can."
Marie smiled at him.
"You're a star, and I'm dying to find out what 200 quid's worth of scent smells like."
"According to the blurb, it's incense, leather, and ambroxan, whatever that is." "Haven't a clue," Jackman said.
"It says here that it's a kind of musky amber odour, but I'd think the strongest tone would be the incense."
Marie started to speak, then stopped, looking hesitant. Jackman noticed. "What are you thinking, Marie?"
She swallowed. "I've just had a flashback to my crash. I thought Ashcroft was going to kill me. He stood over me, and before he kicked the hell out of me, he just stared down at me. He was hurting and full of hate and frustration, but I remember now. In those few seconds, I smelled blood and sweat and motorbike fuel, and aftershave. It was like a hint of the stuff they burn in churches. Incense."
"So even back then he was wearing it," whispered Jackman. "It's his signature. He will always wear it." He turned to Robbie. "Ring your friend. Tell him this really is a matter of urgency, and to please send it. I will pay for delivery. And well done for remembering, Rob. Excellent work, detective."
"Thanks, boss. I'm on it."
And he was. Robbie looked up from his phone, smiling.
"Sorted. He's going to pick it up immediately, and a motorbike will be on its way to us within the hour."
Jackman exhaled. "Fantastic. It's a start, isn't it?"
"It is," said Marie, her eyes shining with resolve. "And this time, he's ours."
Laura Archer remained with Kevin throughout his hospital assessment. Initially, his blood pressure and heart rate had been perilously elevated, but they soon returned to near normal as the initial shock began to fade. He would be kept in for observation and to prepare him for the inevitable results of being witness to so much trauma. At first, he had been stunned. Then he experienced an hour or so of denial, insisting he was perfectly well and should be allowed to get back to his job. Listening to him, one would have thought that nothing out of the ordinary had happened, or that he didn't care. Laura knew different, of course. He was going through the process. After a further hour, he confessed to feeling a terrible helplessness. Why hadn't he been able to do anything to prevent Ernie being killed? This very quickly turned into anger, first at himself, then Alistair Ashcroft. And then he broke down. Laura sat with him, her gentle voice explaining that everything he was going through was natural and a normal reaction to such a traumatic event. He should allow his emotions to express themselves, and he should give himself time to move through the stages. "Human beings are remarkably good at coping with traumatic experiences, so long as they understand what is happening to them," she smiled at him. "Don't beat yourself up, Kevin. Everything that happened, every time, was out of your control."
"I feel bad that I was mean to him. Maybe not outwardly, but I could have been kinder. I mean, he might have had a reason for behaving like he did. Maybe he had a problem."
"But if he never told you, how would you know?" Laura said.
"But I never asked, did I?
I could have made the effort to find out if there was something in his life that was affecting him, but I didn't."
He shook his head.
Just like all the others, I believed he was nothing but a lazy slob.
Well, maybe he was, but no matter what he was or wasn't, he was an innocent victim of a very bad man.
Kevin sighed. Like Christopher, Barney and William.
Like anyone who is unlucky enough to come to the attention of that psychopath.
Laura saw Kevin's father and mother looking anxiously in their direction. They had gone to the hospital cafeteria while the psychiatric team interviewed Kevin, and were now hoping to spend a little time with their son.
Are you happy for me to go and make a couple of phone calls, Kevin? I won't be long. Your parents are here, and they'd like to see you. Are you happy with that?
Kevin nodded. She stood up and beckoned to them. Laura had never met a bishop before, and found him remarkably sympathetic. He would be good for Kevin. He seemed to have just the right amount of empathy without indulging in histrionics. On the other hand, Kevin's mother, Penny, was so anxious that she looked as if she needed help herself. Laura hoped this would pass because right now, Kevin needed calm reassurance, not a mother who was a sobbing emotional mess. But after a few words of reassurance, Penny gathered herself together.
Of course, it was such terrible news to receive, and seeing him like this,
she shuddered.
I'm so sorry, but don't worry, we'll be there for him.
Outside, Laura sat down on a bench in a small paved area close to the entrance. She needed a few moments on her own, away from all the anguish and heartbreak that Ashcroft was so good at causing. It took her several minutes to realize that a light rain had started to fall and she was getting wet. She went back inside, and looking for somewhere quiet to sit, made her way to the hospital Faith room. She sat down in front of a large, brightly colored mural. It depicted a pastoral scene with rolling hills, small copses of trees, and fields of corn. A bright sun shone in a cloudless azure sky. She could almost hear birdsong and the chirrup of crickets. For a while, she immersed herself in that scene, felt the warmth of the sun on her skin, smelt the clover and the grass beneath her feet. She listened to skylarks, and a gentle breeze ruffled her hair. Peace. After a while, she allowed herself to think about Alistair Ashcroft. On the last occasion on which she had terrorized Sultan Lefen, she had seen the results of his handiwork firsthand. The memory of what he did would stay with her forever. She had also watched him devastate the lives of those who were trying to stop him. She reminded herself that Ashcroft was not omnipotent. One day, he would be brought to justice. Meanwhile, the trail of wreckage, the shattered lives he was leaving in his wake, was mounting every day. Even she had not been spared. His invasion of her sacred space had affected her much more deeply than she admitted to Jackman. Laura believed that Ashcroft was driven forward by his belief in his own omnipotence. He would make an interesting subject for study, once he was safely behind bars. She was so deep in thought that she didn't hear the door click, followed by the sound of footsteps.
"I knew I'd find you here,"
she gasped, spun round.
"Sorry, I didn't mean to startle you. I didn't want to disturb you in case you were praying."
"Sam."
Her heart stopped racing.
"I was miles away, and I certainly wasn't praying."
Sam sat down next to her.
"Jackman told me what happened. I called in on young Kevin Stoner, and his father told me you had stepped out for a while."
He looked around the faith room.
"This is where I would come too, if it was raining, and I couldn't sit outside."
They sat together in silence for a while, until Laura whispered,
"He's an enigma, isn't he?
He isn't conforming to the usual model. I would have thought that by now he would have begun to devolve, become more chaotic, even sloppy. Think of the dramatic mood swings he exhibited just before the police almost caught him that last time. I would have put money on them escalating, but he seems even more controlled than before."
"I wonder," said Sam, "if he uses the periods between his killing episodes to step out of himself completely and become a different person for a while. Adopting another persona might enable him to regroup in some way."
Laura nodded slowly.
"We know he had various existences before. In most of them, he was a charitable, altruistic person. People who knew him at those times loved and admired him. He even passed himself off as a psychological counsellor at one point, I seem to remember.
From what we know from his file, that's how he rolls. I think he likes to be in the company of needy, damaged, vulnerable people, mused Sam, and becomes their support and mentor, and he revels in the adoration they show him.
All of that would support his self-belief and make him stronger. Unwittingly, they are feeding his psychosis. Then, when he is recharged, he starts killing again. God!
If he wasn't so dangerous, I'd admire his patience, Sam grimaced. But as it is, he just scares me.
You aren't alone, Sam. I keep remembering that he promised to meet me in person. The thought terrifies me.
I haven't forgotten, my dear young friend. And it's one reason I'm here. You shouldn't be wandering around alone, should you? Sam said sternly. There are police patrolling the hospital, but they can't watch everyone. I know you can't let Ashcroft rule your life, but as you said yourself, he marked your card. Even if it was just an empty threat, you have to take it seriously. Laura felt a rush of affection for her old friend. She slipped her arm through his.
I can't think about that too deeply, Sam, or I'd never step out of the door. I won't let that monster imprison me. If he preys on weakness, then I'm damned if I'm going to be weak.
Just be careful. Discretion and all that. Sam patted her hand. You are a precious commodity, Laura Archer, and I'm not the only one who thinks so.
There was a silence for a moment or two. I cannot begin to understand what Jackman is going through at present, Laura said. I don't mean just worrying over me, it's everything. His old nemesis, Ashcroft, another maniac with a gun who has now turned to killing police officers. Everyone he loves or cares about under threat, and the responsibility for a town's safety all on his shoulders. How long can he keep this up, Sam?
He turned to her and said, I believe he will, Laura, until Ashcroft and his hired gun are safely behind bars, or in the morgue. His adrenaline is pumping and he's in fight mode. He'll see this through, I know it. It's the aftermath that worries me, but we'll deal with that when the time comes.
And that nightmare? I know it still bothers him.
Let's hope that with everything else he has to deal with, the memory of that dream will fade. He's not a fanciful man, is he? Jackman doesn't believe in omens and portents. It was simply terrifyingly real, and it was about Marie and the man who killed his sister-in-law, so obviously it will have affected him. That's totally understandable.
Sam sounded so certain that Laura felt her spirits lift. She recalled how Jackman suddenly seemed to change. It was as if he had shifted his whole game and brought a different attitude to bear on the situation. She said as much to Sam.
You know as well as I do that he's developed a coping mechanism and it's working. Sam smiled. Now, young lady, are you going to do as Uncle Sam says and not go dashing off alone anymore?
She nodded. I'll be careful, I promise.
That's not quite the same thing.
He looked at her over the rim of his spectacles. No, I mean it, Sam. I won't underestimate Ashcroft's threat, but life has to go on.
Just remember, it's the only one you have. Don't throw it away. He stood up. Right, sermon over. Let's get back to Kevin, eh?